Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, angels sent from up above, you know you made my world light up. When I was down, when I was hurt, you came to lift me up. Life is a dream.
Hudson County, folks, you know, it is always in Union City. Insider NJ probably brings to you Politically Direct, and I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 9th of May, the year 2019, and folks, I hope you're all having a wonderful spring. Certainly in advance, I want to wish all the moms out there a very happy Mother's Day coming up this weekend. A big shout out to my mom, to my aunt, and to my grandmother, celebrating hopefully 101 years of age next month. But I'm so blessed to have them for this Mother's Day. For all of you tonight listening in, if you're lucky enough to have your moms with you, enjoy it this weekend for Mother's Day. It's a special time of year. Really, Mother's Day is every day, folks, for everything that our moms do for us. You know, I can't say enough about my mom, how supportive she is and encouraging. And yeah, you know what, throughout the years, you know, has my mom spoiled me more than my dad? Maybe, you know, at times, certainly, you know, I think I'm very lucky for that, and I love my mom very much for it, and, you know, it's something that we're lucky enough to have great moms, you know, enjoy that, and certainly maximize the time this weekend on a Mother's Day. So again, a shout out to all the great moms out there listening here tonight on Blog Talk Radio. Of course, I want to thank you again for listening from wherever and however you might be doing so throughout the Garden State, and of course, to all my friends throughout the good old U.S. of A. Now, you can write to the show's inbox at any time, ladies and gentlemen, which is politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Once again, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Again, don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me directly on Instagram at Professor Fernando Uribe. Also, hit me up on Twitter at Professor F. Uribe. And of course, for all you Facebook subscribers, please go to the official page for Politically Direct, click the like button, share it on your walls, and tell your friends to do the same. Now, I do want to hear from you tonight at some point, folks. So call me toll free, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll free number tonight, 818-572-8032. And our toll free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Again, once you click on the website, folks, at the very top, you'll see the subscribe button. Click on that one, and you'll be automatically enrolled in the morning intelligence briefing, free of charge. So in the mornings, when you're scrolling through your newsfeed or scrolling through your email, maybe watching the cable sort of morning shows, whether it's Fox and Friends, Morning Joe, or New Day, perhaps you're watching the sports debate shows like I like to watch, which is Fox Sports, whether it's First Things First or Undisputed or maybe First Take on ESPN. I'm always on my phone, and I know you are too. So as you're going through your inbox, guess what? You might get a lot of junk mail, but one thing that definitely isn't junk is the Morning Intelligence Briefing. That's brought to you by, again, Insider NJ. It's the best journalism, folks, you'll find every single morning while you're having your morning coffee. Nobody does it better, again, than Insider NJ. Don't forget to follow them on Twitter and also like them on Facebook. And I cannot say it enough, folks. Don't forget to start and end your day with Insider NJ. Now, the opinions and views expressed tonight here and every week on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, or the staff. And, you know, it got me thinking tonight, folks, as we have a great guest coming up in just a few minutes, so you want to stick around for her. She's a tremendous wealth of information, a fellow Rutgers alumnus, so I'm very excited in having her here on the program. And, folks, I cannot say enough when I think about the state of journalism in New Jersey, and quite frankly, who gets vilified, who gets admired, and everybody else in between. And you know what? Tonight, I'm going to stick up for Insider NJ. And that is the subject of my first shot. Now, folks, let me be very clear tonight. You know, one of the things I take a lot of pride in on this program is partnering with Insider NJ. And I can't say enough about, at the very top, the Graham family, for their faith in my abilities, for Pete Oneglia, the general manager of Insider NJ, and also Max Pizarro, the editor-in-chief, because we're a team here. And we're a team that, quite frankly, you know, is someone that, you know, believes in me, you know. And you know what? One of the things that I really, really enjoy about being part of the Insider NJ team is that we're all very versatile. And I'll be the first one to say this because I can. It's my show. I'm certainly not a fan of all the columnists on Insider NJ. I'm not going to, like, name them. I don't think I need to do that, you know. But one of the things that I appreciate about being part of this team is that it is a team. And I think we all bring a certain different type of skill set to this, you know, this sort of this endeavor, and that's journalism. And that's something that I'm very proud of. And I don't write a column every week or every day, and I'm not sort of engaging in sort of the traditional print journalism that a lot of journalists, I think, are accustomed to. But, folks, what I do on this program each and every week live, again, every Thursday nights at 9 p.m. via Blog Talk Radio and Insider NJ, is to bring you what I feel, number one, are the best guests throughout the state of New Jersey, and also to provide you, my loyal listening audience, fair, objective analysis and commentary about the political scene in New Jersey. And I know I do that. I've been doing this show going on about 18 months now, and my traffic has been very strong. My bosses are very happy with the content. And listen, they may not always be happy with my selection of guests. It might fluctuate. I might have maybe a few conservatives in a row, but then I'll have a few liberals in a row, and then I'll have some moderates in a row. And that's the great thing about this show, folks. It's diversity. It's versatility. And again, you know, I read the news feeds. I read what Insider publishes every day. And again, I'll argue it's the best journalism in the state. And, you know, people have an opinion. People are going to always opine on the Facebook page for Insider NJ, maybe the Twitter page as well. And they might express some disapproval about some of the content. And listen, I'll be very honest with you. There are times I read some of the columns and I'm just like, you know, I sort of sit there scratching my head. But you know what? We're part of a team. And it sort of reminds me of playing sports back in high school and then even in college and even playing like intramural, right? Like, let's, you know, the weather's getting warmer. So guess what? You know, we're playing softball, for example, right? And one of the things that I learned about teamwork and camaraderie is you don't always have to like your teammates. But on game day or when you have to step up to the plate, when you have to go on the field and produce as a team, you do that. You know, you put all that stuff aside. And that's something that I know I take a lot of pride here on this program every week, representing Insider NJ the best I can, but more so representing Insider NJ the brand. And I get it. Listen, are there some columnists that sometimes drive you crazy with some of their articles? Absolutely. And they know who they are, and whether they're doing it for clickbait or whether they're doing it because they just want to be inflammatory or controversial, hey, that's them. And I'm not going to tell them how to do their job, as very well I would not like them telling me how to do my job here. But we're a team, and I'm going to support them. But what I'm not going to tolerate is anyone, whether it be on my Facebook page, for Pose the Director, my personal Facebook page, denigrating Insider NJ. Because you know what? They don't deserve it. And yes, I'm sure as you're listening tonight, you're going to say, well, Fernando's an employee. Fernando's going to stick up for his employer, and Fernando's not going to rock the boat. I'm going to tell you something. You know me personally. You know that when I have to stick up for something, no matter how unpopular it is or if it's going to piss people off, I'm going to do it. I learned a long time ago that sometimes, you know, the hardest things require the most strength, that the most difficult things to do require the most conviction. You have to have the will to stand up for what you think is right. And again, you may not be liked for it. You might even get vilified for it. I'm going to tell you something. It's something that I take with considerable pride on this program, and I take with a lot of pride on social media. And you can talk all you want about Insider, and you can talk about some of its content, but folks, I challenge you to find me better journalism in the state of New Jersey than where you find it on Insider NJ. And this is not me being a homer. This is not me being a mark for my employer. Because I'm going to tell you something. Long before I ever worked for Insider NJ, newsflash, folks, Max Pizarro and Peter Neglia worked for a news operation called Politicker NJ. And you know what? Long before I ever collected a paycheck from Insider NJ, I used to read Max Pizarro's articles regularly. Okay? And let me tell you something. Short of, you know, Michael Aaron, who I called the dean of New Jersey journalism because I've had him on my program and I've been lucky enough to be on his program on NJTV. But Max Pizarro, pound for pound, and I'm going to get, you know, I might use a little sports analogy here. Pound for pound, I would make the case that Max Pizarro is the best journalist in the state of New Jersey. And I know Max personally, so again, this might not sound like the most objective opinion, but folks, you read his content. I've been reading it for years. This isn't just some guy that I happen to be paired with as teammates with this company and just say, oh, you know, well, I like Max. I like what he does. I've been liking Max for years. And he's a guy that does tremendous work as the editor-in-chief of Insider. Everybody under him, all his columnists that work for him, put up great content as well. I may not like all of it. I may not agree with a lot of the content, the rhetoric on there, but it's well-written. It's well-researched. It's really well articulated. And that's why I stand by Insider so much. And that's why tonight I really, really want to sort of put it out there that, you know, when I see people sort of ridiculing Insider NJ or vilifying it, you know, listen, you're entitled to your opinion, and that's fine, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And the fact is that for well over 16 months, Insider NJ has consistently produced tremendous traffic online in terms of its unique visitors, both daily and monthly. So you don't get to those numbers by just being, you know, I don't know, fabricating stuff. And we all know there might be some news publications out there online that might not have the most credible people in charge of it. And we all know what they are and who they are, and that's fine. I'm not here to sort of try people in the court of public opinion. That's fine. You read whatever you want to read, and whoever you want to deem credible, that's your business. I can tell you right now, tonight, I'm standing up for Insider NJ because as far as I'm concerned, they are the best source of journalism anywhere in New Jersey, bar none. And I'm proud to partner with them. I'm going to continue to partner with them. And you know what? It makes a difference because this podcast, you know, offers good content all by itself. But let me tell you something. When you partner with a powerhouse like Insider NJ, it makes my job a hell of a lot easier. So you know what? As I said at the beginning of the program, and I'm going to say it again. You know what? For the best journalism, you can always depend on www.insidernj.com. Trust me, folks. I wouldn't lie to you here. I've never lied to you on this program for going on 18 months now. All right? And this is something I take very seriously when it comes to my integrity and my credibility. I wouldn't partner with someone if I didn't believe in them. And vice versa. Listen, and mind you, I'm very, very grateful, as I said at the start of this monologue, to the Graham family. I'm grateful to Peter Neglia. I'm grateful to Max Pizarro. Why? Because they believe in what I'm doing. And if they didn't, you know what? It's a business. I get it. It's about results. It's about producing traffic. It's about producing, you know, likes and everything else and generating conversation online and generating a buzz. If I wasn't doing my job, I wouldn't be here either. So you know what? I think comparably and collectively, we're all working our insider NJ. And for those of you out there that don't want to recognize it because you have a specific bias against us, well, I don't know what to tell you. But we're going to continue working hard. We're going to continue putting out exceptional journalism. And all I got to say is that, you know what, at some point in time, we're going to win you over. You may not like us, and that's all well and good, but I can tell you, you will damn well respect us when it's all said and done. And I know that a lot of New Jerseyans turn to Insider NJ for their news each and every day, and that's not going to change. And folks, that is the subject of my first shot right here on Blog Talk Radio. Folks, again, 818-572-8032, the toll-free number tonight if you want to call in and opine. I'd love to take calls during the evening here tonight, folks. We have a great guest come up in just a few moments. Again, 818-572-8032, toll-free number tonight, brought to you by Insider NJ. So again, folks, we'll be taking some calls if you wish to call in, and it'd be great to sort of hear what you have to say about sort of the political scene right now in the state of New Jersey. Without question, there's a lot going on today. Certainly, a couple of things I sort of want to bring your attention to, a little bit of a rundown. Report came out today, right out of Politico and Jay. Nice reporting by them over there. Apparently, State Senate President Steve Sweeney is not ruling out a 2021 primary against the governor. Apparently, Steve Sweeney won't rule out running against Governor Murphy in a primary challenge in 2021. And you know what? Good for him. I think I've been very, very clear on this program. I'm a big fan of State Senate President Sweeney. I'm a fan of, you know, what he's doing with trying to make sure that the governor doesn't hold New Jerseyans hostage with his budget when it comes to property tax relief. And I get that the governor is sort of like, you know, very euphoric about implementing a millionaire's tax and trying to get that done. And I understand that. That's the governor's trying to generate revenue. But holding property tax relief hostage for this is absolutely inexcusable. And good for State Senate President Steve Sweeney for standing up for New Jerseyans as he did this week. And you know what? As far as I'm concerned, if he wants to sort of challenge Governor Murphy in 2021, go for it. I'll tell you right now, I understand the governor's approval rating, I think, was somewhere in the 40s, I think. Last time I read, I think there was a Monmouth University poll, I think, at the end of last year that articulated the governor having like a 42 to 43% approval rating. I don't know how that's even possible. And listen, I like Governor Murphy. I've met him. I've interacted with him on numerous occasions. Nice guy. Very, very amicable. A guy you want to have a conversation. He's a guy you want to have a beer with. But the idea of governing in New Jersey, I think, has brought in some problems. Whether it's been the task of, you know, trying to get minimum wage passed with the legislature, which took a full calendar year. As we all know, the marijuana bill that was supposed to come to a vote on both the state Senate floor and the assembly floor in March, on March 25th, as a matter of fact, guess what? It was tabled because apparently there weren't enough votes in both the assembly and the state Senate. And it seems like the bills are dead. And it just seems like, you know, the governor is so intent on revenue and fixated on money, money, money. I get it. We need money in New Jersey. We're in a fiscal rut right now. But you know what, folks? How about just sort of curtailing spending? How about the fact that, you know, it seems like there isn't a tax that the governor hasn't met that he doesn't like? And that seems to be sort of a common talking point about Governor Murphy. And I understand that the legislature has a fair share of blame, too. I understand that Steve Sweeney and Craig Coughlin, the two legislative leaders, I think, get a lot of flack as well. But, folks, I mean, these are very different Democrats, as you can tell here right now in New Jersey. You know, Steve Sweeney is a very different Democrat than Phil Murphy is. And I think that's coming to a head right now. And clearly, if that's out there, listen, I'm going to tell you something. Steve Sweeney is a very calculated guy. He doesn't, you know, sort of put a lot out there unless he wants it out there. And when ask that, you know, if he's going to rule out a primary challenge to Governor Murphy, I'll tell you right now, if I'm Governor Murphy, I'm terrified, because Steve Sweeney has enough political capital in New Jersey that he can give Murphy a serious challenge. And don't be surprised, come June 2021, that he doesn't try that. Now, again, we're still 2 years away from this. A lot can change. Their rapport can improve tremendously. I'm going to tell you something. Between now and then, if the governor doesn't get his act together when it comes to this budget and allowing more spending, more taxation, more sort of bending over backwards to accommodate illegals in New Jersey rather than taxpayers and homeowners, that's going to piss off the population. Trust me, guys, I know what I'm talking about here. So, you know, again, if I were Governor Murphy, I would not ignore this. I would take it very seriously. Now, if you want to dismiss it, do so at your own peril. But I can tell you that Steve Sweeney's capital is still very strong, and it's going to continue being strong, you know, without a doubt, for the coming months ahead here in the state of New Jersey. Folks, 8:21 here on the East Coast. And right now, it's my pleasure to welcome to the program a fellow Rutgers alumnus, fellow academic, fellow PhD, which I'm very excited to congratulate on that, but also a very, very, very invested Latina activist and labor rights leader. Please welcome to the program tonight, folks, once again, Ms. Patricia Campos Medina. Dr. Medina, what's going on, honey?
Not much. Yeah, I'm just sorry for being a little late. I was trying to get to a place where I could call you directly. So
glad to be here. Patricia.
Yeah.
No, listen,
yeah.
Thank you for coming on. And again, congratulations as a fellow Rutgers alumnus. Excited to
thank
see that.
You.
I was happy to see that on your Instagram. So, so listen, Patricia, there's a lot to talk about today. And let's get to it. You know, first and foremost, I have to say that I've always admired you, Patricia. I very much admire your tenacity to discuss the issues, whether it's sort of verbally, like on any appearance you have on radio shows or television shows, but also what you put out there in print. And, you know, you are a very, very dedicated Latina. You are very, very opinionated, which is great, because so am I. So I respect that about you. But it seems today, Patricia, that, you know, we're living in a time, I think, of complete tribalism. And I think among,
yep,
especially among Latinos and among Hispanics, and I'm going to give you an example because I really want to hear what you have to say about this. And, you know, one of the things that, whether it is statewide with Governor Murphy or whether it's nationally with the president, you know, I think at times when it comes to issues involving the Latino community, I think there can be a very serious generational disconnect, Patricia. And, mm-hmm, the reason I use that as an example is because, for example, my parents, my dad's in his early 70s, my mom's in her early 60s. They immigrated under very different circumstances more than 50 years ago. My mom left communism and tyranny in Cuba. My dad left, you know, a pretty, you know, mediocre economy in Colombia to come here. Yes, immigration laws were very different for my parents when they came here legally more than half a century ago, you know, but for people like my parents, Patricia, who came here, they've worked hard, they implemented a good work ethic in me. And when they see that at the national and at the state level, it seems like elected officials, whether, you know, predominantly, let's say, from the Democratic Party here in New Jersey with Governor Murphy or many Democrats nationally, especially candidates that are running for president, seem to be sort of fixated on this idea about being very accommodating to illegals. And you know what? To people like my parents, Patricia, you know, that really upsets them. And my parents are not racist. They're not bigots. But the problem is that we live in this time of tribalism that at times, you know, within the Latino community, someone like my parents, they'll be looked upon and said, oh, Fernando and Sierra Uribe, esos son racistas, because they're immigrants, but they don't understand the struggle. No, Patricia, they do. And I think that's a disconnect that you have to work through.
Yeah, well, when I said that we do live in a time of tribalism, I agree with you because I think that we, everybody's, there's so much discord and the language that we're using to talk about our difference of opinions on things is so,
sure.
has become so politically offensive. And, you know, we went so much from not being to be politically correct to now just being so rude and mean and nasty, beginning from our commander-in-chief. So we got to a point that we, you know, rather than debate difference of opinions about us all, or about how to solve problems, we are like going to the gutter, right? Right, to insult somebody as not being mm-hmm. patriotic or as not as being racist against somebody. But I think what we're suffering from is actually from a problem of very, very short memory. The United States has a very short memory of its own history of what happens. And, you know, when you said that your parents, people like your parents, sort of feel upset, I guess, as to what they see as accommodating to immigrants today. Perhaps what they don't understand is the dynamics that immigrants today have to live under. For example, you said that your parents immigrated because they were living communist and oppressive Cuba. I tell you that my parents immigrated because, you know, they were fleeing oppressive conditions and from their government, which was a right-wing government in El Salvador that time. So, while Cubans who were fleeing communism and an oppressive government from the left were granted papers at a faster rate than Central Americans who were fleeing progressive right-wing oppressive right-wing governments were not. Mm-hmm. And I was just talking to, that's where I, you know, I graduated from Rutgers with my doctorate, mostly focusing on political science and the migration and the history of Central American migration, because what people, even all the Hispanics don't understand, and some Cubans, and I'm married to a half Cuban and half Puerto Rican family, even that family, some of the family doesn't understand that, you know, fleeing similar conditions of oppressive governments, because any government from the left or the right can be oppressive. So if you're fleeing that kind of sentiment, but you are treated differently when you come to this country, that sets a different beginning for you. So if you, I don't know if you're aware, I mean, the majority of Central Americans, when they arrived here in the 1980s, 98% of them were denied political asylum, although they were fleeing wars in El Salvador, in Guatemala, and in Honduras, who were military bases for both the operation against Nicaragua and all the operations that were happening, on behalf of conservative governments in Guatemala and El Salvador. So 98% of these people did not get political asylum. So what do they have to do? They have to survive through many years of going through the process that was ultimately denied. So fast forward to today, when you have a second mass migration of Central America that are fleeing another type of social unrest. It is a social unrest fueled by drugs and fueled by massive deportation of gang leaders that were deported through the 90s and the early 2000s back to those countries that were poor to begin with. So there's a short memory that people don't realize, that the reason why you have this massive migration of people who had no documents is that we never made a process for them to have access to documents. Because there hasn't been any other legalization program since the 1986 legalization program. So how are people supposed to get online when there's no line to get on to get papers? So, you know, that's what we should be debating. When we say we want immigration reform, is because we want a process by which those people who were denied political asylum in the 80s, who had to live generations without papers, how are they supposed to get on the line? There's no line. And people forget that, and they don't seek to understand it because it's easier to to repeat the soundbite of Fox News and all those anti-immigrant things that do not propose any solutions to the real problem of people actually working, paying taxes, and raising the kids with very few rights in this country.
Well,
and so when you said that we're being accommodating, it's because because people have to leave. People are leaving here. People are, you know, it's not, immigrants are not just not working. They're working. So if you have, if you as a community have a whole population that is working, that is living in your apartments, that is paying your rent, that is shopping in your in your districts, that it has bank accounts, that has buys houses, how are you going to ignore that population? And that's the reality of Hudson County. That's the reality of Elizabeth. That's the reality of New Jersey. So when you say we are being accommodating, no, we are being realistic that those people are living here, they're working here, and they deserve the same rights that any other person who lives here has. The states don't have the right to change immigration. Under the Constitution, cannot change immigration law, but they can act on a way that they create better opportunities for people to be productive in their communities.
Well, Patricia, you raise good points, and let me be very clear. When I'm using the narrative about, you know, the perception of being accommodating, I think that, you know, that's a soundbite that comes up a lot, I think, whether it be in either conservative or maybe progressive slash liberal type of, you know, dialogue that we see all the time. And again, I'll just give you an example. I think sometimes that, you know, whether it's blown out of proportion or it gets magnified because, you know, we live in this digital world, Patricia, where we live on our smartphones. You know, obviously, we're getting our news on our news feeds all the time. It, you know, the 24-hour news cycle has been there for 20-plus years. The Internet is celebrating 25 years this summer in terms of its birthday. And social media has been around for at least 10 years. So the way we've gotten information, I think, has really, I think, exploded. But, for example, I'll use this as a discussion point today. I remember talking with my father this week. My father said, Mijo, did you see that article this week on Insider NJ where the governor decided to, like, come out and say, well, we're going to sort of, you know, appropriate some money away from a firefighter's fund, right? Where, again, when you get into specifics, right, it wasn't necessarily about taking away from firefighters, but some funding that's used for either accommodations of some kind. And the first thing that my father and somebody else said, he said to me, Mijo, wait a minute. Governor Murphy is all about giving money to illegals and setting up a legal fund to help illegals, but you want to take money away from firefighters? ¿Qué es eso? And you know what, Patricia? Whether it's my dad who's 70 years old or people in that demographic, now, mind you, the governor faced some backlash. He did a 180, not a surprise, and clarified, like, oh, we're not going to do that. But do you see, like, this is the thing that for my parents' generation, they see stuff like this. And immediately, they're going to be
but that's when believe the sound bites and they don't dig deeper. And that's why people like you and me, who are supposed to be the for better or for worse, the intellectual people who read and are informed, should actually use those opportunities to inform and educate people about what's going on. With the Firefighters Fund, it was a proposal of how to move. To move funds around so that they can fill the budget in different ways, that he can come up with a budget. You know,
I understand.
In New Jersey, you know, you have to have a fully funded budget, which it doesn't happen in other states, but that's the mandate in the United States. So what he was doing is saying that the fire fund has extra flush money, so we can move some of that money to use it where we need it. That's what Chris Christie did for 8 years. That's why he was governor. He moved funds around that were flush with cash and moved them around. That's how we ended up with a transportation trust fund that is depleted, because when the transportation trust fund had money and it was flush, he moved it around to plug in his budget so that he wouldn't have to raise taxes. So did the same people say that he was misappropriating the trust fund, transportation fund? Nobody criticizing him. Or if we did, but nobody took the time to say, oh, what Murphy's doing is nothing different than what Chris Christie did for 8 years. The only difference is that the Governor Murphy is saying we cannot just keep moving money around. We have to generate new money. or we are not going to ever be able to fulfill our obligations. So, I mean, you also have to, like, dig deeper in and explain to people, okay, maybe it's not a good idea. It's not a good idea to take a fund that is flush with cash, and, you know, maybe we shouldn't because it is their money. But that's how it works. If you have flush money in one side, you move it to the other, right? That doesn't mean that that money will never come back to the firefighters fund. It just means that at this point, the excess money is going to be somewhere else. He didn't do it. He got backlash because, you know, I understand why the firefighters don't want their money touched, because every time you touch money, that money might not come back. I mean, that's what happened with the public sector's pensions, right?
Yeah.
Beginning with Governor Whitman, who started taking the extra pension money because they didn't need it and started putting it somewhere else. That money never came back to the pension fund. And that's how the workers' pension fund it doesn't have money, because they stopped putting money because they thought it had a lot. But when people started retiring, the pension fund went down. So, you know, I understand their concern, but Governor Murphy was not doing anything different than Chris Christie did for 8 years, and when he refused to raise taxes and he just needed to find money to plug his budgets.
No, listen, I agree with that, and I'm glad you broke that down for us tonight, Patricia. But like anything else, it's, you know what, we live in this world, right, where optics matter, right? And whether you know, hell or high water, sink or swim, you know, in the world we live in, especially about politics, right, whether it's at the state level or national, sometimes the optics matter. And yes, you're right. It's important to dig deep into information to get the right information out there. And I'm glad you broke that down.
And educate people, yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, when people have the wrong information, it's our responsibility to say, no, you know, that's how it might sound, but this is what the reality is. Because there's a lot of misinformation out there, and I think that the media used to have the responsibility to correct bad information and dig deeper into details, but unfortunately very few outlets actually take the time to like dig deeper into they stick to the talking points. So that's what I actually like coming to these things to talk to you, because you get an opportunity to like clarify. Dude, I am for a balanced budget. I am for all the stuff, you know. I want lower property taxes. I mean, I own a home. But how do you get to that if you don't change what has been happening for the last 20 years in the state? Right? That necessitates a real ability to disagree without being disagreeable, and to understand that there has to be some sacrifices made somewhere. But the bottom line is that it's not okay to, I am a labor union leader, so every union pension fund, I respect it, but it's not okay to touch the funds of the firefighters or the police officers or those unions that have more power and are higher earners than it is to touch the pension fund of a secretary. Who might be earning $35,000, $45,000 in a public sector job. Why is it okay to touch her pension fund and destroy it, and not okay to touch the other one? Now, I'm not saying it's okay to touch any pension fund, but I'm saying it's a matter of who has power and who's perceived as not having power. And of course, in this day and age, in this state, unions. Some unions are more connected to certain power structures than others. So therefore, they are able to protect their assets a little bit more than others that have to fight to defend them, like CWA.
No, listen, that's a great observation. And I'm glad you're breaking that down for us. I think it's important, Patricia, for our audience to understand sort of the inner workings, I think, of state government. I think for the most part, a lot of us sort of fall into the trap where, you know, a lot of New Jerseyans don't make the effort to sort of understand how government works, whether it's budgets or understanding pensions, because they're such vital components of state government. And you brought up something interesting before. And folks, if you're just joining us right now, it's 8:35 here on the East Coast. It's my pleasure to have you here. I'm Politically Direct, labor leader and Latina activist, and also a fellow Rutgers alumnus, Ms. Patricia Campos Medina, here tonight on Blog Talk Radio. Patricia, you mentioned something before about generating money. We need money in New Jersey. That's been well known for some time. And one of the ideas and one of the sort of different types of legislation that's been introduced, I know that up here in North Hudson where I live, in the 32nd Legislative District, the state senator, Nicholas Sacco, and his two assembly running mates, Assemblywoman Angelica Jimenez and Assemblyman Pedro Mejia, collectively introduced a bill to have driver's licenses be allowed and be permissible for illegals in New Jersey. And certainly that's generated a lot of buzz. A lot of the talking points have been about public safety, which, listen, I understand, because where I live in Hudson County, it's very densely populated. Here in New Jersey, here in Hudson County, yes, there's a massive access to mass transit. You know, you can, where I live, you can live without a car and kind of get around. You know, there's plenty of buses that run 24 hours a day. They're not the most sanitary things in the world, but they're there. You have New Jersey Transit, you have light rails, you have the PATH train. So there is an access to mass transit here in North Hudson and Hudson County. But when you move across the state, of course, it's not as accessible. And certainly not just in Hudson County, but throughout the state, there are certain portions or, you know, concentrations of illegals living in New Jersey. And they need to go to work. They need to take their kids to school. They need to go grocery shopping. So I understand the motive of keeping our roads safe by making sure that illegals that are driving are insured. Because the last thing you ever want is to be driving and, God forbid, you're in an accident, and the person that you're in an accident with isn't insured or doesn't even have a license. I mean, that's frustrating. I understand that. But there's also sort of, and again, there's this sort of mindset, going back to my parents. Well, they'll say, hey, you know, I get it. They're, you know, fine. They're facing some hardship, but they're here illegally. Why are we going to reward them? Why, you know, my parents will say, I'm a citizen. When I have to renew my license, guess what? I have to produce all this documentation. I have to produce 6 points of ID to renew my license. Meanwhile, esta gente are just going there. They're going to have a license bestowed to them, regardless of residency or immigration status. And again, I think it goes back to a generational divide, Patricia, right?
I think that it is a generational divide, because I think folks like your parents and my, came at a time in this country where there were a way for people to legalize their status. And to them, it is incomprehensible how there's no way to become legal. And there's people that say, well, why haven't you applied for a green card? Why aren't you a citizen? And for those people, it's very difficult for them to understand that a lot of people would do that if they had the opportunity to do that. I interview a guy who is a TPS holder who owns a construction company, and he's about $10 million in construction company, has contracts all over the state, and he is TPS, and he's about, if he doesn't get it renewed, he's going to be deported. And people tell him all the time, oh, he's Hispanic, because he's a well-off man. And they say, ¿por qué no aplicas para una residencia? And, you know, and people will say, well, you have money, you could get it. But the bottom line is that even if you're a millionaire, if you did not bring $1 million into the United States, you cannot even get into the millionaire path for a green card. So he hires thousands of people, and he himself cannot qualify for a path to permanent residency. So people don't understand that. No, that lack of, it doesn't equate with the experience that I had when I came to this country. So, mm-hmm. in that dynamic. Now, in the driver's license dynamic, driver's license is about, they're not just going to get a driver's license without having to prove their identity. They have to prove their identity, and they have to prove their residency. There's other, you know, there's an expansion of type of documents that they have to provide, but that doesn't mean they still have to provide identity, and they still have to provide residency to be able to get it. They're going to get a license that identifies them that way, But that license is a state issue license. Doesn't allow, you know, it's not a federal ID, so it's not giving them any equal access to you and me that have an ID that has is a federal access. I can get into into an airport, or I can get out of the country. So it's going to be differentiated, and there's already the 16 states have already done it, and the District of Columbia already have mm-hmm. the type of driving license that we are talking about that New Jersey undocumented workers to have access to. So, you know, it's going to be different. And it has in Assemblywoman Aneki Hano has spent a long time studying the different ways that you securitize a proof of identity and proof of residency, because it's been done before. So this whole argument that Speaker Coughlin says that he needs to study the bill and see what, you know, and figure is secure and meets Patriot Act or the security concerns, that is all baloney, because Assemblywoman Quijano has been working on this for a long time, and there's enough evidence in other states about how the state driver's licenses do not violate any other federal ID security concerns.
Patricia, do you think, I'm sorry to cut you off, do you think that maybe the hesitation on Coughlin's part has anything to do with the fact that all 80 assembly seats are up this November? Or do you think that it would still pass anyway?
I mean, I believe that he is making a calculation that the issue of, you know, just like your parents and how you frame it, that it's giving something away to illegals, that narrative is the narrative that's going to win. And therefore, if he does it, he is going to put some of his members in the assembly at danger of not being reelected. So he's mm-hmm. making a calculation that he wants to be on the safe side of winning, rather than being on the safe side of history or on the safe side of doing the right policy by New Jersey. You know, and I think that that's how we got to the point where we are, where politicians started making policy to get reelected and not making policy to make their society better. And I think that citizens are getting tired of that. So, you know, so Coughlin is saying, if I put it for a vote, I'm going to force all Democrats to vote on it, and some of them are in districts that are, you know, that are middle of the road, and they might lose the re-election, and I need to keep my caucus. That's the calculation that he's making.
Patricia, I don't know about that. I mean, the margin is 54 to 26. I mean, Democrats have a very safe lead in the assembly. I
agree.
I understand. Yeah,
that's his calculation. I don't agree with it.
I'm surprised.
Because he told his caucus he's not going to put it up for a vote because he's not going to make them vote for it. You know what the other calculation that they are? And this is mm-hmm. this is where I criticize the Republican Party, but I also criticize the Democratic Party. And I'm a Democrat. I am a proud Democrat. And I will forever defend the values of my party. But sometimes leaders in our party are concerned more about getting reelected the safe way and the easy way, because they want to get reelected with the same people that are 60 years old or that are 50 years old who are voting with preconceptions of how things were, instead of engaging. So those politicians rather, you know, go back to the voters that always vote, rather than spend the time educating voters, new voters, young voters, about what good policy is all about. So, you know, some districts, they don't talk to new voters. They talk to the voters that always vote, which are the machine votes. And, you know, I think that is the dynamics that, as an activist, as a person who is a progressive, I call myself a progressive, that's the dynamic that we need to change in New Jersey. That, you know, and it's changing, that we need to engage new voters and younger voters to change this lockstep that some conservative pockets of the Democratic Party have a hold on power in Trenton.
Well, you know what? And that's interesting, because I've talked about it on the program repeatedly, where just because there's a D next to your name doesn't mean you're cut out of the same cloth within the Democratic Party. Steve Sweeney and Phil Murphy are very different Democrats. I mean, fundamentally
yes,
different Democrats. And we'll get to them in a minute. But you brought up a very interesting key word. I wanted to sort of cover this with you, being academics that you and I are. And, you know, the word progressive is a very interesting word, Patricia, because it triggers different reactions in different people. And this is where I'm going to sort of like, well, we're going to put the state politics on hold for a minute. We're going to touch upon something national for a moment, because I really want to get your thoughts on this. And again, I'm going to sort of, you know, go back to sort of use my parents as an example, because, you know, they represent an older demographic, right? And they're Latino. And, you know, when we hear the word progressive, right, you know, my family's kind of interesting. My dad's a very big Trump supporter, and my mom doesn't like the president at all, right? But one thing that they can sort of agree on is the idea that, you know, while my dad is very conservative, my mom isn't as conservative. I'm more moderate. I'm like center right on some issues, but I'm like center left on like a lot of social issues. But one thing my parents sort of agree on, and again, going back to maybe the generational disconnect, you know, going into 2020, you know, my parents said to me, Mijo, I don't know where you're going to watch the debates in June that are coming from Miami on June 26th and June 27th. But my dad said to me, Mijo, wherever you're going to watch it, tell me, because I want to buy a bucket of popcorn and I want to sit there and I want to listen to estos locos that are super, super liberal, that are whatever you want to call them, progressive, socialist, however they want to identify themselves at. And people like my parents, because I've talked to other people in their age demographic, and they all tell me the same thing. So, you know, Fernando, we're not fans of the president. Just like, and they said to me, Fernando, the way you describe it on your program is perfect. And this is what I've said, Patricia. Many times, I don't like the fact that the president lacks decorum. I don't like the fact that the president many times lacks civility. There are times that his tweeting drives me absolutely insane. But Patricia, between now and next year, if the current economic climate continues, where there's record unemployment for Latinos, for people of color, for women, and if the Democratic Party keeps moving to the left with ideas like reducing the age of voting to 16, eliminating the Electoral College, allowing violent inmates to vote while in prison, free this, free that. I'm going to tell you, Patricia, I got bad news for people. The president's not a likable guy, but people are going to vote with their pockets and say, you know what, I don't like this guy. Este hombre no me gusta. But you know what? If the economy is going pretty well, to quote James Carville, the very famous Clinton strategist from the 90s, you know what?
Yeah,
that might get enough for next year. What do you think?
Well, I think that there is the whole premise that the economy is doing pretty well for the majority of Americans is a premise that is false. There is, you know, we're still living at a time that people are barely holding on to a middle class livelihood. They're barely holding on to their home, which was supposed to be the proof of that you made it or the American dream. Their children are loaded with debt. They can't get jobs. They get out of college with degrees, and they cannot get a job that pays them more than the minimum wage. Thank God we raised it in New Jersey. So the whole premise that, you know, yeah, Wall Street is doing great. If you're an investor and you have millions of money invested in Wall Street, but if you are a hardworking middle-class professional, you are living paycheck to paycheck. So the economy is doing good for the majority of people is a false premise. So what I think is going to happen is that all those young people who believe their parents' story that if you got an education you can get a job and you can make it, and they're not making it. Those are the people who are getting engaged and demanding that the politics of the next generation, that the politics needs to change so that that you create opportunity for them. There's mothers, women. Women are the electorate that, you know, used to be a safe electorate for the Republicans, because because they, you know, middle class women, they felt like, you know, everything is working fine for me. Why do I change? Things are not working fine for middle class women, because they have to take care of their parents on one end, who are living on limited pensions or no pensions at all. And they have to take care of their kids coming back home because they cannot get a job. So that's the sandwich generation that they call it. And those women are very frustrated. And in addition to the fact that they perhaps had a college degree and had to take time off to take care of their parents or their kids, and now they're not earning as much as other men are earning, and they're stuck in this place of trying to balance that. But they are frustrated with that economic stagnation, and they're also frustrated with the fact that they taught their kids to be nice people and be decent human beings, and yet the president of the United States is insulting everybody and boasting about his sexual exploits. So, you know, I think that women is going to be a problem for the Republican Party, and young people now more than ever are engaged because they see no future for themselves. And that is sad. You know, I tell people when I graduated from college, from Cornell University, I came out with $10,000 in student debt. That was a lot. It took me 15 years to pay that debt. $10,000. I see college students right now that came out of college with $150,000 debt. That's a home. You know, when are they going to rid of that debt? Never. That population is not your parents' population, because your parents' population used to be like, I don't have the money, I won't do it. But you know what used to happen back then? My husband is older than me. When he went to NJIT to get his college degree, tuition was very cheap, $1,000. You know.
Sure.
What is tuition now at NJIT or Rutgers? How do you think? You know.
Because they invested
in public education for higher ed. So now it's making more sense. So how do you change that? And young people are changing it. And if Donald Trump doesn't really change his style, because it is, for him, it's not about substance. It's about wagging the dog, you know. He wants to wag the dog so that his supporters keep applauding him. But there's no something substantive, so people won't change.
Patricia, you raise a good point about education. And listen, as someone that teaches in academia, I see firsthand the real disadvantage that students are at when it comes to the cost of a college education today, when it comes to fees. And really, listen, college has become a business now, right? I think we learned that, you and I, for many years, right? I'm still paying back my loans from graduate school and everything. But I think, and this is, we could probably do an entire show separately about higher education, right? But one thing you brought up right now, and this is something I tell my students all the time, and I think with the younger generation too, I think we're sort of learning more. I think a lot of students across the country, I think, in colleges, universities nationwide, are learning the hard way, is, yes, our parents always told us to go to college, get a degree that's going to help us make money and have a living. I agree with that. The problem, though, is, Patricia, and this is something that I have said all the time on this program, I said it at career fairs, when my department chair asked me to represent our department, I tell my students all the time, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to be honest with you. Pick a major, pick a career that can help you. Listen, if you want to get rich, that's one thing. But if you want to have a life where you can maybe earn a modest income and earn a living, that's great. But Patricia, you know what the problem though is? And listen, we're both academics, so we live this, right? The problem is that I think collectively, what we're seeing nationally is that there isn't enough of an insistence on younger generations to be pragmatic and realistic. I tell my students all the time, because I teach at a community college, I say, do me a favor. When you pick a major that's going to help you have a career. Don't pick a Mickey Mouse major that, again, and I'll give you an example. I hope I don't offend anybody tonight, but you know, when I tell my students, if you're going to pick a liberal arts major, pick a major that's going to help you get a career. If you want to major in women's studies and philosophy and poetry, Patricia, those majors they stink.
But
they're not going to get you a job.
But see, this is, you know, we
go on.
Yeah, I mean, look, listen. we can engage in an intellectual debate about what the purpose of education is. You know, mm-hmm. the purpose of education is to have an informed, educated populace so that we can make
yes.
good decisions on our governance, right? So,
sure. yep.
so when we, you know, when our founding fathers, or you know, we decided to have a public education free from kindergarten to 12th grade, that was the whole point, to have an educated workforce, because that is good for our economies, that workers are able
sure.
to be able
sure.
to understand and be ready to perform. Now, higher education was always about was always about how do you create sort of mobility in our society. So now I agree that not everyone should be placed in an academic track for higher education. You know, in the 80s and 90s, we encouraged more kids to get into college rather than encourage them to get into a career. And so what we are seeing in the trades is like we don't have a lot of young people willing to go into being an electrician or carpenter, or you know, places that you can actually make a decent living, but that's not where our education system was channeling them to. So I think that this resurgence of apprenticeship and this resurgence of doing technical training in the high school,
yes.
that is a good move.
Trade school, yeah.
Yes, trade mm-hmm. school, because not every kid has the interest to go into the liberal arts education track, and we were channeling everyone there at the same time that we were reducing opportunities for other type of jobs. So I disagree with the notion that all universities should do is to prepare you for a job, because then you become a job training ground for companies, and the corporations are telling the students what to learn and how to learn, and then you're producing thinking machines for corporations. You're not producing
sure.
thinking human beings for society, okay?
That's fair.
And the role
fair.
Of university is to create human beings that think about what type of society they want to. It can be in either one or the other. So, you know, there's other type of universities. Like Rutgers is an academic-based university.
Yes.
You know, you have
mm-hmm.
NJIT, which is a technical university. You have a university like Rowan, which is more like a partnership with businesses so that they can create, train a workforce for businesses. So there's different models, right? So, but we cannot... Not all higher education can be about preparing people for a job, because what you're doing is giving corporations, you know, you need to prepare citizens that are engaged and are informed. And I think that part of where we're at in this country right now, that people are not questioning what some leaders are saying, or are not demanding more for public elected officials, and are just buying the... Or demanding more from the media, because now the media doesn't really report; they just talk. They're talking heads everywhere. Yeah.
You
so,
know what, Patricia? I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said that, because I'm so happy you said that tonight, because that's a topic, and I'm sorry to cut you off, that I really want to cover with you tonight, because I have been pounding this message on this program for months on here about the dishonesty of media. And one of the reasons, and again, it sort of goes back to the previous point about how we look at the idea of, you know, progressive and conservative, or what's liberal or what's moderate. It's amazing to me, Patricia, about, I think, in general, the dishonesty of media, as you mentioned right now, about the way we look at elected officials. And again, sort of going back to the example I gave you about sort of, you know, the generational disconnect that exists, for example, as I mentioned with my parents, my dad said to me, "Mijo, I can't wait for these debates in June, because I can't wait for like six or seven or eight of these Democrats to come on stage and just make a fool of themselves when they come out here and either stuff that they said come back to haunt them." I'll give you an example, because I really want to get your thoughts on this. And I know that, you know, obviously in the polls don't mean anything. I think we learned that after 2016. But today, for example, obviously, if you look at the polls, former Vice President Joe Biden is comfortably in the lead right now, ahead of all of his Democratic running mates. And I remember a friend of mine sent me an article today, and he said to me, "Fernando, check out this quote." And he called me, he said, "Check out, someone today said, quote, we are obligated to give illegal immigrants health care. And then he said that same person 12 years ago said, quote, they need to learn to speak English and they learn and they have to learn to deal like everyone else in order to gain citizenship. And if they don't, you send them back. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And I tried to research because I was like, well, who said this? And you know who said that, Patricia? Joe Biden. And he said to me,
well, Joe Biden is a walking contradiction.
No, I know. But he said to me, this is the problem with the media. The media won't call him out on it. The media won't hold him accountable. And for whatever reason, the media is in love with him very much the same way they were in love with Hillary. And I said this to my friends who are Democrats and progressives and liberals. I said, if you want to take the safe guy, that's fine. But the problem is that people are going to look at the rule of the incumbent and the challenger. And if the best, if Democrats want to take a centrist and try to make them appeal to progressives, that's not going to work. You need a progressive to appeal to centrists because that's how you're going to win. If not, I mean, Patricia, the reality is going to be, again, it's going to be 4 more years if this is what we're looking at. And I really want to get your thoughts on this, please.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to make clear, I am not supporting Biden. I think that he was a fine vice president, and he's a walking contradiction, and he would have served us better not staying in the race, but other people disagree, and it's a primary, and we will see what happens. I am the vice chair for Bernie Sanders in New Jersey, and I took that assignment very seriously, but I took it because I believe that, you know, the only true progressive right now on the candidate is Bernie Sanders, because things that he was saying last time around are the ones that everybody else is running on. So he has been a progressive way before everybody else. And I say this knowing that last time around I was with Hillary Clinton, because I believe that the record of her husband should not be her, you know, should not just be attributed to her. But so now Biden is a walking contradiction because he has been in the Senate for 60 years. And if you look at his record from since I've been 60 years is a long time to be in politics. You have been, mm-hmm. This country was a totally different place 60 years ago. So when sure. I see all the things that they keep bringing out about what he said and what he did, I'm like, holy cow, you know, that's not even the Biden I thought was the vice president. Right. But people, you know, we are a redeeming country. We believe in people changing their ways. So we see if voters believe it. Now, the problem that I have with Joe Biden, well, he has the right to be on the race that anybody else does. But I do agree with you that there is this low affair right now. We're building him up. We believe that the polls are a lot closer between Bernie and Biden, and the only reason that there's such a big split is because the media or current polls are only polling voters, traditional Democratic voters. If we think the Bernie phenomenon, you have a lot of more younger people, a lot more women, younger women, and a lot of more people of color that are more exciting about the consistency of his message. So I think that if we, you know, we will continue to talk to that generation of voters, we'll continue to organize them, and we believe that at the end of the day, the actual numbers are a lot more closer, and it's all going, you know, there's a lot of people running for a Democratic nomination, which is exciting. You know, last time, one of the problems is that everybody coronated Hillary Clinton as the winner, and they didn't want anybody else around. So now, you know what? If everybody can engage and get their followers excited about voting and getting rid of Trump, hopefully they will do what they have pledged to do, which is to engage those voters in the general election as well, so that we can bring all Democrats together to defeat Trump, whether you are with Biden or you are with Bernie or you are with, Beto. So I am excited. I mean,
Patricia,
I'm excited that we
Patricia,
have different candidates
Patricia,
now.
Patricia, mm-hmm. Patricia, I adore you. Please don't say Beto. His name is Robert. There is nothing Hispano, that guy. It drives
me crazy.
He calls
himself Beto. Yeah.
Okay, I can call myself Fluffy. It doesn't make me so. Do you understand this? So
no.
That drives me crazy.
Yeah, that's his nickname, Beto. Beto, you know.
That guy is as Irish as the Lucky Charms guy on the box. Come on.
He was born in a border town. He lived in a border town. You know how many white guys in Texas have Latino sounding names?
I understand that. It just drives me crazy. But you raised a good point about progressives, and I really want to get your thoughts on this, because today, tangibly, Patricia, what progressive ideas are really sellable today? Because, again, at the end of the day, you know, we're going to see what happens next month during the debate.
Well,
we're going to see how the candidates attack each other. But moving forward, what sort of progressive ideas are really
well, Medicare for all. Medicare for all is a very popular idea because the bottom line is that we made some progress with Obamacare, but Obamacare is still a private-driven program, and it hasn't lowered the cost of health care. So, Medicare for all, it is a very popular progressive idea. Debt forgiveness for student loans. That is a progressive idea. And free college tuition for community colleges. That is a progressive idea. Investment in green energy and creating green energy jobs. So moving away from fossil fuels that are destroying our climate and that's a progressive idea. And those are popular ideas. You know, that are taking root. So,
well, Patricia,
you know,
one thing is popular. I mean, you're right about popular. There's no question. I've seen the data. I've seen the way that they've been articulated. I don't disagree that they're not popular ideas. But relatively speaking, though, how tangible are they and how realistic are they in terms of aside from the Medicare issue, which I know that, listen, I think I'm with you and we haven't really touched on it, but I firmly believe that healthcare is a right. I think that a healthy population is better for the economy. It reduces the strain on our Medicare, on our healthcare system. It reduces the strain on our hospitals and our ERs. So a healthier population is good for our country. It's good for the economy. So I'm with you on that in terms of healthcare. How we get there and how we try to sort of, you know, regulate healthcare is difficult because, listen, we can barely regulate healthcare for veterans. Right. So to regulate it for a country of 300 million plus people is also difficult. Right. It's easier in France where it's 50 million people of a population. But here it's infinitely much more difficult. But I'm with you that healthcare is a right that we should practice. Again, a healthy population is better for the economy. A healthy population is better for society. Listen, my grandmother is 100 years old. Si Dios quiere, next month she's going to be 101 years old. A large part of that is the fact that science and medicine has evolved tremendously since the time that my grandmother was a teenager. So thank God for science and medicine that she has seen advancements. The same thing for my parents and other any ailments that people face. I'm all with you about healthcare, but when it comes to progressive ideas, how realistic is it to sell this to a country that, listen, in New Jersey, New York, Patricia, and in California, this is like pancakes. La gente se lo come. But if you try to sell this to Midwest states where you have moderate Democrats or people in the South, how do you do it?
Well, it's a process of educating the population. The crisis is real. The biggest reason for personal bankruptcy for Americans, it is health care, an illness of yourself or a relative. And that is a reality for Midwest America, for East Coast America, and for California. So people know that. And if you start talking to them about a real solution, which we already have a large program that works, Medicare is a highly successful program because it's able to negotiate directly for the cost of health care rather than having insurance companies in the middle negotiating. You know, I get so frustrated that for one procedure, you get 20 pieces of paper, 20 mailings. I said, what the heck are they wasting paper? How many people are deciding whether I can have a procedure or not? It's just, it's mind-boggling. No, Medicare has already proven that it's effective and it's cost-effective and it's able to reduce, you know, to improve healthcare outcomes for people. So why, if we have a program that is successful, why can't that be expanded and follow that model? That's why we call it Medicare for All. Because, you know, we already have something that works. You know, once it expands, there has to be some kinks to it, but it's better than what we have today. You know, the failures of our system right now. So I believe that that people are already asking for it, and it's just a matter of getting over the special interests in this country that are driven by insurance companies who do not want to stop being the middlemen for healthcare in this country. And that is a tough cookie. But I think that if as citizens we demand that change, that's the only thing that's going to change it. You know, we demanding that our healthcare becomes a right.
I don't disagree with you, and I think it requires the citizenry here in the country to really be engaged and be, I think, invested in causes like this. I think that's how you bring about the right amount of change
right? And we need to elect politicians who want to engage in that type of debate, not just politicians who want to get elected so they can get their own pension and have a safe job for life, you know?
Oh, no, absolutely. No, listen, you're absolutely right on that. And we'll get back to the national in a minute, because I really wanted to pick your brain on that. But getting back to the state real quick, Patricia, because I know that aside from being an activist as a Latina, you're also a labor rights leader. And one of the things you mentioned before was obviously this January, both the governor and the legislature, after a full calendar year of what I would call dilly-dallying around when it comes to raising the minimum wage, apparently they came to an agreement where I think over a period of 5 years – the minimum wage will go up to $15 by July of 2024. The problem with that, Patricia, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, is the problem is that it doesn't account for the fact that, okay, that's great, you're going to raise the minimum wage, but that doesn't mean that the cost of living is not going to go up, that real estate is not going to go up, and New Jerseyans are still going to be in tough shape in 2024. So I think that, you know, as a labor rights leader, and I really want to get your thoughts on this, that, you know, I feel that the legislature and the governor really dragged their feet on this, because it was one of Governor Murphy's campaign promises in 2017. It took a full calendar year to get this done. And even after a full calendar year, it still seems like, listen, it wasn't realistic to just do $15 in one shot. But I think 5 years might be a little bit too late or too long, because, again, we're not accounting for inflation and everything else. How concerned are you as a labor leader about the fact that it took this long to get it done and the fact that it's going to get dragged out for 5 years in New Jersey?
Well, you know, say that's how the sausage gets made, right?
Yes.
Negotiating and moving things along. The bottom line is that we don't have, despite the fact that we are a state that is majority Democratic, we still have Democrats who are in different places on this issue. The New Jersey voters supported an increase in the minimum wage. They wanted a clean increase, an immediate increase. But, you know, the sausage gets made with a lot of people having different opinions and different interests. And we did not have a legislature that was willing to enact a full 15. They wanted some sort of, separation and timing, and it was part of the negotiation. But at the end of the day, we were able to cover a lot more people than we had in the past. About 3 million people get an increase on wages that are immediate in June. That is a pump of new money into the economy that goes directly into our local communities, because people who live in the minimum wage, they spend their money right away. They don't put it in the bank because they have immediate costs that they need to cover. So we were able to raise wages for 3 million people. That is a big accomplishment. Now, the phasing in of the increases, you know, we feel like by the time 5 years come around, the wage should be $20, not $15. But we will continue to advocate for more increases, because, you know, we should have had an increase for a long time ago. So We understand that there has to be negotiations, and we agree that we are happy that we were able to cover more. There were some exceptions, for example, waitresses who are mostly women. Some of them are not covered right away. Agricultural workers are not covered at the same fast pace. So there's a lot of people who were left behind that we will have to continue to keep fighting for them. The other thing that needs to happen is that we need to have an increase in the federal minimum wage, because the federal minimum wage hasn't been increased for years. We're still at about, I think we're at about $8.15 at the federal level. So we've been able to get an increase at the state level, but what we really need is a federal minimum wage increase. I think that the last time we increased it was when Senator Kennedy was still alive, and he championed it in the late 1990s. So we need a federal increase in the minimum wage so all our states are competing at the same. The bottom is not so low that with the bottom gets increased.
Well, you know what? That's a great observation. I think the way we look at the minimum wage, Patricia, I think is challenging because, for the most part, you know, for as far back as we can remember, you know, when we were younger, we worked minimum wage jobs, and certainly, I think, you know, there's always rhetoric on both sides of the political aisle that talk about, well, what do you want minimum wage jobs to accomplish? I mean, what should is that something you want to live on? Is that something that you want to make according to inflation? And it's a really challenging topic, right? Because I think that in the end of the day, in New Jersey, you know, New Jersey continues to be expensive. And I wanted to really get your thoughts on this, because it was a talking point last year coming up to the midterm elections where, you know, every district except one went blue in New Jersey. In the House, and certainly Democrats and liberals and progressives that ran campaigns last year ran on the fact that New Jersey is expensive. New Jersey continues to be expensive. But Patricia, I really want to get your thoughts on this, because as a labor rights leader and as someone that works with unions, this is what drives me crazy. Because at the end of the day, whether or not it was a popular talking point for candidates last year running for House seats saying, oh, you know what, New Jersey is expensive, and it's Washington's fault that New Jersey is so expensive. Patricia, this is the thing, and I've talked about this before with other guests, and I've talked about it with my audience, and I've had people write me emails and say, Fernando, you're absolutely right. Nobody says it better than the way you just said it. The problem with New Jersey, and this predates Donald Trump, this predates Barack Obama, I think it even predates George W. Bush. My issue with New Jersey and the cost of living and how expensive it is, it's not about who's in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The problem for almost 25 years now has been one specific political party in control in Trenton of the legislature. And a newsflash to people, it's been the Democratic Party that's controlled the legislature for almost a quarter century. Yes, we've had Chris Christie for 8 years. We had John Corzine for four. We've had Republican governors. We've had Democrat governors. At the end of the day, Patricia, what drives me crazy is that the problem with New Jersey being expensive, the highest property taxes, that spending continues to be a problem. It seems like whoever's in the governor's office or in the legislature, they seem to, you know, they've never disliked the tax that they've never come across. You know what I'm saying? They've loved the tax every time they see it. It's been Trenton.
Oh, we haven't raised.
The problem is Trenton.
The sort of the sticking point in New Jersey politics, and one of the issues that always sort of gets sticky, is the issue of property taxes. It is, you know, yeah, New Jersey is a very expensive state because we are part of the New York region, which is one of the most populated, the highest income two states in the country. And we have high-income people who live and work here in this area, so it is a high-cost state. We have some of the most educated workers in the country that work here, and the people with the most income in this country. So in this state, so it is that is why Rizzuto is the highest state. Now, all the reason that we are not able to reduce our property tax cost is because we refuse to reduce the level of municipal governments. You have so many municipalities or school systems that are so small that need to be supported by property taxes, that we should really, that is the problem with reducing our, you know, our property taxes. But every governor that has tried to do something about merging municipalities or merging school systems gets really hits a political button, like touching Social Security at the national level. You know, that's sort of like the for real in New Jersey politics. You cannot tell a municipality to reduce or to merge with to another municipality or a school system to merge with a municipality, because there's sort of like this disconnection between why do I pay so much higher taxes, and it's all Trenton's fault. You know, Trenton has tried to do that, to fix the problem they haven't achieved, because it's a, like I said, it's a political hot potato. Now, we have not, you know, when you talk about raising taxes, since, you know, the last person who attempted to raise taxes in New Jersey was the Governor Florio, who attempted to raise taxes the last time, and he lost office. And we have
technically, Patricia, I mean, the last governor to raise taxes is Governor Murphy.
Raise taxes on sales tax? Sales tax? Because Chris Christie put it down. You know, people, you know, he brought it down before he left to increase some taxes and brought another tax up. So, Chris Christie also raised taxes in his last
He did. Listen, Patricia, you will not.
And he
raised.
They both raised sales taxes. So.
Oh yeah.
I mean, sales taxes is a regressive tax. You know that.
Oh no. Patricia, you will not find me as a fan of Chris Christie. I mean, aside from the fact that we're both Cowboys fans, that's the only thing I share in common with Governor Christie. I have plenty of complaints about Governor Christie. I think that his 8 years leaves a very mixed legacy for him. I think he's in denial about it. You know,
he refused to raise taxes. Let me get into this also, because this is important. He refused to raise taxes to raise income. But at the same time, what did he do? He gave billions of incentives to corporations through EDA. And we gave billions of money away to companies that did not comply with the commitments that they made to this state, right? So it's okay to give money away to corporations, but it's not okay to tax them, or it's not okay to say if you're making money, you ought to pay a little bit more. So, you know, they talk about the budget not being funded or not having enough money to fund the budget. Why are we giving away billions and billions of dollars to corporations? It's like giving billions of dollars to Jeff Bezos to move to New Jersey. And that's a problem that Chris Christie, Jeff Bezos could fund our budget. And we're still giving him our hard-paying money. Those are the kind of things that we need to end. We need to end corporate welfare. And we need to, you know, we need to reform EDA. We need to stop the subsidies, and we need to be able to tell companies if you have a legitimate reason for why you need public funding, you need to prove to us that you're going to create good jobs and that you're going to do what you promised you were going to do. But we have story after story of companies that got money under Chris Christie, who put a hole in the budget, because that was money that was spent. So it's okay to give it to rich people and to corporations, but it was not okay to put money in the budget to fund a secretary who works in the public housing or in the education department who needs $30,000 a year on her pension. So you see the logic? It's like, where are we prioritizing? What are we prioritizing? Subsidizing rich people or subsidizing working people?
No, listen, I'm with you on that, Patricia, because I'm not a fan of corporate welfare. I was not happy seeing some stats in Forbes that Amazon made a ridiculous amount of profits last year and paid very, very little income tax. And that was wrong. And that's something that
we should not be incentivizing him. I'm like, why does he need New Jersey's money. You know, when he doesn't pay a penny and he's sitting and he can buy a country if he wants. I mean, you know, I don't know the amount of his assets, but he could.
No, listen, I'm with you. I'm with you, and it's disappointing. And I think that's one of those stains on Governor Christie's legacy, I think, that I think is going to haunt him for a while. I'm with you on that.
And I think
that
Senator Sweeney, if he doesn't accept that there needs to be reform to EDA, he is going to learn that New Jersey voters are not going to tolerate the continuation of corporate welfare. So, you know, there has to be some incentive maybe to startups or to new ideas or to innovation. You know, they need money. But if you are an established corporation that's fueling money, why would you need more of our money? So this whole debate that is going on around about the budget and about EDA reform is really about who gets to have the benefits of taxes. And for the last 10 years, it has been corporate welfare that has been putting a hole in our capacity to meet our budget demands. And if that doesn't get reformed, then there's really not a room for doing any of the other priorities that the Governor Murphy cares about, that we care about, because we got him elected. So we understand that he is fighting entrenched interests on EDA, on the tax incentive program in EDA. But I think he has voters on his side, because voters do not want to see more corporate welfare coming out of Trenton. And if Senator Sweeney doesn't understand that, he will find himself damaged by this debate.
Listen, I don't disagree with you, and I know that today in the news, I don't know if you saw that today on Insider NJ. It was reported by Politico NJ earlier today, Patricia, but there's rumors that Steve Sweeney might want to primary challenge Murphy in 2021. That's interesting. I mean, it seems like Sweeney's popularity
he was running for governor, right? So he wanted to be a governor for a while.
It seems like today, when he was asked about whether or not he would primary challenge the governor in years past, he was very quiet. He said, no, absolutely not. I'm a Democrat. I support the governor. Today, he was very noncommittal. And that, I think that's a telltale sign that Sweeney still has political capital in the state. And I think that if the governor's approval rating doesn't sort of pick up, I wouldn't be surprised 2 years from now that Sweeney might say, you know what, I think Murphy's vulnerable and I might want to take him out. Again, there's a lot of time between now and June 2021.
Yeah,
a lot can change in New Jersey, for sure.
Yeah.
A lot can change.
I think these are the shenanigans of our budget, right? Like I should stop taking vacation in June, because it's like I'm on vacation and I'm checking my emails. You know, because it's like it's always so much drama around before the budget in New Jersey gets enacted.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think it's part of that, and the bottom line is that I think that the people that's who support Governor Murphy and got him elected, are committed to helping him see the agenda that he got elected on. And the people that support Sweeney, I mean, he has his supporters, will support what his vision of the state is. It's just a matter of who is better organized and who has the ability to drive the message. You know, sometimes I do feel that, maybe Senator Sweeney has the upper hand, but sometimes I feel like we as citizens have the upper hand and that we need to change the debate. It shouldn't be about attacking. I mean, they're trying to make it about condom. This is not about condom. We all want condom to do better, just like we want Newark to do better, just like we want Jersey City to do better. This is not about condom. You know,
I agree with you.
Who got money? And what were the rules that they were supposed to follow and they didn't? You know, and if you are for government accountability, you are for government accountability at EDA. You know, and that's what this should be about, not about condom. It's a distraction.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And Patricia, one of the things I wanted to sort of share with you before we end for tonight, first of all, I feel I could have you on for 4 hours and we still not get through everything. Like, that's how interesting our conversations are. I know you're on vacation. You're an absolute sweetheart.
No, I'm actually working. And actually
working.
And teaching a seminar at Cornell University, so today and tomorrow.
That's fantastic. Well, listen, I want to thank you for your time tonight, your valuable time, from one academic to another. I hope you enjoyed our program tonight. I think it was very illuminating for our audience. I think it was informative. I think that certainly it reminds us how different we can be, both ideologically, but we can still be civil and talk intellectually. And that's one of the reasons I really love you being a guest on this show, because you help bring out the best in me as a host. And I know that I'm hoping I bring out the best in you as a guest, and we can have conversations, because that's what we need, Patricia. We need that in today's
political climate. We need to have conversations. I agree.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So again,
first of all, I want to thank you for that. We can disagree and not be disagreeable.
Absolutely.
And I think we need to get back to that. So,
exactly.
And then vote our conscience and vote our values, but vote.
No, definitely. I want to thank you for your time tonight. I definitely want you back on later in the summer after the budget is passed. I want to get your thoughts about what happened with the budget, what you liked, what you didn't like. I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about. But I want to wish you the best of luck with what you're doing. Congratulations again on graduating. And also, happy Mother's Day to you, Patricia. Feliz Día de las Madres.
Thank you.
I hope you have
gracias.
A great one. And do me a favor. Tell everybody you know, please, to tune in to Politically Direct. It's your favorite podcast about politics in New Jersey. Please tell everybody you know how much you love the show, okay?
Yes, I will. Thank you for the invitation, and happy to be back anytime. Thank you.
God bless you. Good luck again, and
bye-bye.
Thanks for coming on. Bye-bye.
Okay,
now.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. 9:35 here on the East Coast. What a great program tonight, ladies and gentlemen, with Patricia Campos Medina, fellow Rutgers alumnus, and of course also Latina activist and labor rights leader. Folks, tremendous program tonight. If you missed any part of the broadcast, folks, and really, really educational program tonight, tune in again. You can go at the top of the hour. You'll hear the episode in its entirety by going to www.insidernj.com/podcasts. You can listen to it from any device, anywhere, anytime. And I really, really appreciate the feedback there. If you have an idea for a suggestion for a guest or a topic, folks, write to the show, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Again, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram @politicallydirectnj. Don't forget to follow me directly on Instagram @ProfessorFernandoUribe. Brand new likes, tons of new followers every day. I know people love my memes on my Instagram stories, whether they're political, sports, comic book related, anything. I appreciate all the love you guys give me. Also, hit me up on Twitter, folks. I always love to hear what you have to say on Twitter @ProfessorFUribe. Don't forget to check out Politically Direct on Facebook. Like the page. Tell your friends to do the same. And of course, folks, don't forget to check out Insider NJ by going to www.insidernj.com/podcast. Again, when you listen to the podcast again here on the program, again, check out the main page, www.insidernj.com, for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the city of New Jersey. Folks, nobody does it better than Insider NJ. Once you go on the website, folks, you can check out their at the very top of the link, there's a subscribe button, and you click on it, and you'll be automatically enrolled in the morning intelligence briefing there, free of charge, delivered to your inbox, or in the morning when you're watching the cable news shows or sports shows, and you're scrolling through your phone or your tablet. Guess what? It'll be there every single morning in your inbox. The best journalism, the best scoops, the best stories, always brought to you by Insider NJ with the morning intelligence briefing. Don't forget to like them on Facebook, folks, and also follow them on Twitter. Again, don't forget to start and end your day with Insider NJ. So whether it's on your morning commute, folks, getting your daily workout in, walking your dog, doing laundry or homework, do me a favor, tune in right here, and you'll be happy that you did. And folks, never forget that it is real, it is here, it is the award-winning Politically Direct. Good night, Newark, the home of my alma mater, Rutgers University, folks, the graduate school there. My fellow alumnus, Patricia Campos Medina, tonight. Great to see her on the show. And, of course, to all my fellow Scarletonites there at Rutgers Newark, especially at the grad school, shout out to them again. Thank you for tuning in here and enjoying the podcast. Folks, do me a favor. Have a great weekend. Please party responsibly. A shout out to all the moms there. Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to my mother, to my aunt, to my grandmother, 100 years strong and counting, and to all the moms out there. It should be Mother's Day every day for everything that you do. We love y'all. Have a great Mother's Day weekend, folks. Enjoy the NBA playoffs. Enjoy Yankee and Mets baseball. And, folks, we'll see you here next week on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, Let's keep on talking.
Oh, angels sent from above, you know you made my world light up. When I was down, when I was hurt, you came to lift me up. Life is a dream and love's a drug. Oh, now I think I must be my youth. When I was a river dried up, you came to